Life Audio.
Welcome to Christian Natural Health with naturopathic Dr. Lauren DeVille. Christian Natural Health is the podcast on how to get and stay healthy, God's way. You'll hear topics on nutrition, exercise, sleep, avoiding toxicity, meditating on scripture, what supplements to take, stress management, defeating anxiety and worry, how to reconcile Eastern medicine approaches with Christianity, and a whole lot more. Now, here's your host, Dr. Lauren.
But look around you, your family, your faith. They're not in the way. They are the way.
From the creators of Jesus Revolution comes the incredible true story.
It's going to be dangerous and scary and giving up. It's not an option.
The story of one family's journey from down under to center stage. Unsung Hero, a For King and Country film starring Candace Cameron Bure and Terry O'Quinn. In theaters now. Visit unsunghero.movie to learn more. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Welcome back to another episode of Christian Natural Health. Today, I'm very excited to have Dr. Gerald Pollack with us. Dr. Pollack maintains an active laboratory at the University of Washington in Seattle. He is the founding editor-in-chief of Water, a multidisciplinary research journal, executive director of the Institute for Venture Science, co-founder of the Fourth Phase Incorporated, and founder of the annual conference on the physics, chemistry, and biology of water. He has received numerous honors, including the Prigogine, how do you pronounce that? Medal for Thermodynamics, the University of Washington Annual Faculty Lecturer, and the NIH Director's Transformative Research Award, and he has the first Emoto Peace Prize. He is recognized internationally as an accomplished speaker and author. Welcome, Jerry. So thank you so much for coming.
Oh, I'm just delighted. Thrilled to be there with you.
Thank you. So I've read several of your books. First, for those who might not be familiar, can you give us a quick description of what easy or exclusion zone water is?
Well, quick description.
No, that's hard.
How to make it a quick description. It's a kind of water that's unlike liquid water. In liquid water, the water molecules are randomly oriented, and they're bouncing around a fierce number of times per second or per femtosecond. Easy water is a kind of, you might say, structured water. That term was originated by Gilbert Ling and others, who was a pioneer in the field. And it's actually a water that is liquid crystalline. In other words, the molecules are organized in some way, like soldiers at attention. Yeah. So that's what just in general, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about easy water or fourth phase water. The two are the same.
Right. Okay. And so why is there a charge separation? I know you talk a lot about that, the idea that the protons and the actual EZ is negatively charged and then the rest is not. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, it happens. It's perhaps the most important feature because, you know, if you have charges that are separated like that, you have a battery and that battery is capable of delivering energy. And we've demonstrated it. We have proof of principle that it actually can do that. So the way it forms is, in general, there are several ways it forms, but one of the principal ways, the way we saw it first, is that we take a gel and we immerse it into a bath of water, and in the water we have little particles, and the idea that we started with was that if there's a region of water that is like a liquid crystal. Liquid crystal is a bit like ice, except that ice is hard and it occurs at a low temperature, but everything is organized. And if it's organized like a crystal, crystals tend to exclude pretty much everything. Otherwise, it would be pure crystals, you know, if they had impurities in it. So yeah. As the crystals are forming, they get rid of, I'm sorry, you have a question?
No, keep going.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they get rid of the impurities. So we were looking in the microscope to try to find a region where the particles are, we use little spheres, microspheres, where they were excluded. And we found it right away. It was right immediately adjacent to the gel surface. And then we tried different gels and we tried different materials. And we found that this was a generality that we could find next to the surfaces. If the surfaces were hydrophilic, which most are, that is water loving, right next to it, we could find a region where all the microspheres were excluded. And we took videos and we could see the region growing and growing as though a region of order was started very small. The original water was transformed into something different, something ordered, something that excluded the spheres. And we found that in extreme circumstances, we could actually see this region growing to as much as a millimeter. You know, you can see with your naked eye. You don't even need a microscope for that.
Right.
But typically it was maybe a third of a millimeter or something like that. We can see it growing. So we later made measurements of the water in that region. We called it exclusion zone because it excluded. That was maybe a mistake because well, it's more than just exclusion is just one of many properties. There are so many properties of this water, all of which differ, we found, from the properties of ordinary liquid water. Mm-hmm. So the region grows, and we decided to stick electrodes in that region to check out the electrical charge. And we were frankly astonished to find that it was negatively charged. H2O is not negatively charged, but this was negatively charged. So it means that the original H2O liquid water had undergone some sort of transformation into this special structure, which we later found out consisted of hexagonal honeycomb sheets, one sheet stacked upon another, and it had negative charge, net negative charge.
Yeah.
So, you know, because it has net negative charge, it can't be H2O because H2O is right. Neutral. It's actually H3O2, which has a negative charge. And then we found that that right next to this region of negative charge was positive charge. When you think about it, you must have that because you started with water, which is neutral. And so somehow the products of that still must add up to neutrality. So we wind up with a liquid crystalline honeycomb sheet-like structure, which many, many sheets stack upon one another with negative charge. And beyond that is positive charge. And one of the questions I'm going to answer, very few people ever ask, but this is a critical question.
Please.
You will know it instantly. So if you have negative charge and positive charge, mm-hmm. what do they want to do? Oh, they want to combine, annihilate one another.
Uh-huh.
So how is it, what I presented to you is that the EZ or fourth phase has negative charge and right next to it or beyond it is positive charge.
And
everybody would expect, what keeps them apart? Well, what keeps them apart is the honeycomb, the nature of the EZ layers. So it consists of a whole bunch of hexagons, and those mm-hmm. hexagons are so small that the positive charge, which consists of hydronium ions, that is protons latched onto water molecules or so-called positively charged water, mm-hmm. can't get in. The holes are just too small.
Yeah.
Right. So they stay out, and therefore Therefore, the negative charge of the easy and the positive charge beyond the easy remain separated. So you have a battery.
Wow. So, okay. Delving a little bit into the idea of the battery. So you plugged in these electrodes. What kind of a charge differential do you actually get for that, from that?
Well, we measure it in millivolts. And I could say that typical potential difference is maybe 50 or 100 millivolts, but it varies. If you're very close to the gel or other nucleating surface, it typically is like 200 millivolts negative. And as you move away from that surface toward the region of the positive charges, it the potential difference begins to diminish, and it goes toward zero. And then you got the positive charge beyond.
Got it. So if somebody wanted to like build one of these in their backyard kind of a thing, would you wanted to build this in a backyard, would you have something to just keep those electrodes in place? And then could you just hook it up to a light bulb or something? Or is there something fancy that you'd need to do in order to make this work?
We've done exactly that. We didn't do it in the backyard. We did it in the
backyard.
But you can do it in the backyard. It works equally well. Yeah. And often when I give presentations, I show a slide of that result. And what you do is you stick one electrode in the negative zone, one electrode in the positive zone, connect that to, an LED. We don't use a conventional light bulb, but you flip the switch so that you make the connection and you can see the light shining. So this is, for me, it's astonishing because it's a previously unrecognized source of energy.
Exactly.
It comes from water. And what I didn't tell you, but you know, because you've read the books, you can't create energy out of nothing.
Right.
All you can do is transform energy from one kind of energy to another. So in order to create this battery, you need to have some kind of input energy.
Right.
And we didn't find it. It was a student in the laboratory, a young undergraduate student who was doing what he wasn't supposed to do. Shined a lamp on the chamber and the region that was illuminated, the exclusion zone grew hugely.
Yeah.
So he called me in and I'd been trying to think of, where does the energy come from? Because I knew that there had to be a source of energy. And you can't exactly plug the experimental chamber into a receptacle on the wall and get some energy.
And charge it.
I was scratching my head so much trying to figure out that I lost all my hair. and there was this young undergraduate student who was naive.
Hold on it, yeah.
And he got it. So it turned out light was responsible, just like photosynthesis. Step one in photosynthesis is light impinges on the plant and the charges are separated. The plus and minus charges in water are separated. Step one, 100% efficient. And what I'm telling you is something very similar. And in fact, we think that we found a kind of generic phenomenon of which photosynthesis is probably the premier demonstration or exponent of that, because nature does something really, really well.
Yeah.
What they haven't figured out, I've never seen them figure out, is why the plus and minus charges don't recombine instantly, what we talked about a moment ago, because they should.
Yeah.
But nobody, as far as I've seen, nobody has ever addressed the question of what keeps the charges apart.
Right.
But I think maybe if the photosynthetic mechanism is similar to what we've found, the first step in photosynthesis, then the explanation should be the same. And it's the easy waters hexagonal honeycomb sheets that don't allow the positive hydronium ions to enter back in.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so the student found that light did it. And after we could see his demonstration, we decided it's really important to do some genuine experiments. And so we examined a wide spectrum of different wavelengths or colors, ranging from the short wavelength, ultraviolet, through the visible spectrum from violet to red, and then beyond that, longer wavelengths, infrared. Mm-hmm. Most of the wavelengths didn't do anything, not beans. And finally, we saw that the infrared was hugely powerful. We found that very modest amounts of infrared light could spectacularly build exclusion zones. And we could actually amplify an exclusion zone in size by a factor of 10 using very, very modest sources of infrared energy. So the bottom line is, yeah, you need energy to create this battery. And the energy, at least one form of energy, comes from infrared light,
right,
which is all around us. If you know, a lot of people don't know much about infrared energy, but you know, they think if you got a toaster and you push down and you can see the glowing orange coils, that, you know, that must be radiant energy or infrared energy. But actually, it's not that, and that's correct, but it's not just that. Everything is generating infrared energy. So if you, for example, in the room that you're in right now, your office or whatever, if you were to turn off all the lights so that pitch dark, you can't see anything, your cell phone camera can't record anything, it's just absolutely black. If you whipped out an infrared camera that is like a regular camera, except that the sensor is sensitive to infrared, not instead of visible light. If you had one of these cameras and the room was totally dark, you get a beautiful image of everything around you, including that clock that sits on the wall and the bookshelves on the other side, because it's all generating infrared energy, which means that it's all around us all the time. And that's, for example, why military people use it at nighttime, because they can see the enemy, they can see the tanks, they can see the guns, they can see everything with an infrared camera. So the energy that's required for building easy is there. It's all around us.
So we've got this ready source. We've got the water and we've got constant infrared energy all around us and also from the sun. Is anybody trying to tap into this, like, at a larger scale?
Well, we're looking to do this. You know, our laboratory we do fundamental research.
Right, of course.
We don't, except for a brief foray into a venture, a commercial venture that one of my students convinced me that we need to go there. I was against it, but he said, "Oh, you don't have to do anything. I'll do everything." And it didn't turn out that way. Anyway,
gotcha.
We did make some progress on one of the devices that came out of our research, but for various reasons, like two people on the board who couldn't get along with one another. I tried to mediate, but unsuccessfully. Mm-hmm. The company, unfortunately, went defunct. So we're making great progress. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we focus on the fundamentals. I have this compelling desire to find out how nature really works, and it's beyond. Beyond biology. Biology is, of course, one of the main aspects, but the work that we do extends beyond. So I don't sort of like to be distracted by engineering development, but I hope others will or do. What you're talking about getting electricity from light and water, it's just, you know, it's so natural, and nature does things usually in the best way possible. So, I'm optimistic that if some company wants to pursue this, it should be possible. And some fundamental research needs to be done about some aspects, and we would be willing to do that in the laboratory. you know, studying the fundamentals, but not the commercial development.
Of course, no sense.
We need money.
Yeah, I imagine. And those two areas, that it's so often that the scientific research on the ground doesn't translate to industry very quickly.
It doesn't. There's so-called valley of death.
Yeah, I can imagine.
You have to get over that valley to make it.
For sure. So, and then from a biology standpoint, as you alluded to, so our cells are what, 70% water, something like that, right?
Well, yeah, it depends on the cell and also depends on your age.
Sure.
When you reach my age, it's a little bit less.
Right. But regardless, so what are the implications from a health standpoint for easy water?
Well, thanks for asking. The implications are central. So first of all, our cells are filled with easy water. Our cells are not filled with liquid water. And the way, the simplest way that you can demonstrate that, if you're brave enough, take a sharp razor blade and cut. Mm-hmm. So you cut yourself. And if the cells were made of liquid water, the water would come pouring out as it would from a breached water pipe. It doesn't happen. The blood comes out for sure, but the water doesn't. Mm-hmm. And amplifying that is a word from several surgeons who told me, you know, they'll cut deeply. That, for example, they'll cut right through a muscle, deep inside, and the water doesn't come out; it stays in. So, it's not liquid water. It's a water that's viscous, gel-like, and it sticks inside the cell. Mm-hmm. And we understand that because inside the cell are lots of solids with hydrophilic surfaces. And the water, the easy water, sticks to those surfaces, so it doesn't come out. So the water in your cells is not liquid water. It's easy water, fourth phase water, or so-called structured water. That's one thing. Now, if that's true, and evidence suggests that it's true, generally accepted view that the negative charge inside the cell, negative electrical potential, the view that you read in the textbook is this has to do with membrane pumps and channels that allow various ions to go in and go out. It's a complicated story, and I think it's wrong. The evidence that it's wrong, I've published a paper, and it's in one or two of my books, but I can simply say one thing just that's highly, highly relevant. If the cytoplasm of the cell is pretty much like a gel, that's well established. It turns out that if you stick an electrode into the gel, no membrane, no pumps, no channels, you get the same electrical potential as you would in the cell. Very similar. It's been shown in various laboratories, including our own. Mm-hmm. So if that's true, then there are no membranes, no pumps, no membrane, nothing. But still, you get the same result. It's hard to argue that, that this potential comes from activity in the membrane since there's no membrane.
Yeah.
That's just one argument of many. So the electrical potential comes from you were about to ask a question, or is it just a...
No, I was. I'm trying to picture. So as you described before, there's this separation of the easy and the bulk water. Inside the cell, it's all structured. Where's the bulk water? Is there any?
Yes and no. Let me explain. In a healthy cell, like, for example, a muscle cell that contracts very well, the water inside the cell is all easy water, giving you a negative charge.
Okay.
But what happens, as I describe in the Cells and Gels book, Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, 2001, the water undergoes a transition. It's the water and the proteins undergo a transition, so-called phase transition, a phenomenon well understood in physical chemistry. And the water changes from the easy or fourth phase water to ordinary liquid water. And then back again after, in a muscle cell, say, after the contraction is over.
Uh-huh.
And so when you ask the question, is the water inside the cell all easy water? Yes and no.
It depends.
So in a muscle cell, if the muscle cell is relaxed, then it's all easy water, a healthy muscle cell. So the water undergoes a transition with the proteins to fold. Proteins are folded and the water then becomes liquid water. And that's the cell doing what it's designed to do. And when it's all over, the situation returns to the initial state. The water becomes ordered again, and the proteins undergo or occupy their extended state. That's, in a word, that's the action of the cell.
Right. It's so elegant. So one thing that you, I think you described either in that book or possibly the other one, is that there's two different ways in which energy is stored. It's the separation and it's also the charge, right? Am I getting
it right?
Okay.
Yes, you are. Exactly.
So ATP, body's energy currency, that ends up happening as a result of some of the phase change. Like, how does one convert into the other?
I'm reluctant to be extremely controversial, but but I have to tell you. There's a fact that. Or that you may not be aware of, and I think your listeners or viewers might not be aware of. So it was, I don't know, 80 years ago or something like that, that the idea came that ATP molecule had a high energy phosphate bond. Uh-huh. Everybody was excited about that because finally, the source of energy could be found.
Okay.
A year later, and if you want to find out about this, what I'm going to tell you, just look on Gilbert Ling's website. Though he passed, the website is still ongoing. It's gilbertling.org. Mm-hmm. And there he describes that a year later, a different group of physical chemists wrote a paper saying, these guys are wrong. They made a mistake, a simple arithmetic error. There is no such thing as a high energy phosphate bond. Well, since that time, nobody has followed up.
Okay.
So the bottom line is that we don't know which group is right. Is it the first group that came up with the original idea of a high energy phosphate bond? Mm-hmm. Or is it the second group who said it's all nuts? There's no such thing as a high energy phosphate bond. So I guess in truth, we don't know whether what you stated as a fact, and everybody believes it is a fact, whether it's true or not true is not clear, because nobody has followed up to check to see which one is correct. So anybody who's seriously interested in that, look at Gilbert Ling's website, get the reference and read it and draw your own opinion. So bottom line is, maybe high energy phosphate bond and ATP is responsible for all the action. Mm-hmm. And if so, I have a hard time going from what I told you about the evidence for cell action to ATP. On the other hand, if it's not correct, then we're talking about energy coming from charge separation or charge concentration. So right. If the cell is full of negative charge and that negative charge, each of those negative charges repels all the others. And they want to get as far away as possible from one another. Mm-hmm. And that is potential energy. The fact that all these charges, negative charges are squeezed together and they want to get away from each other. And the getting away from each other is the energy that drives it.
Wow. So that's a whole frontier study that just sort of hasn't
absolutely.
Been.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
It would, there is the possibility, if it turns out that the ATP story is not correct, there's the possibility that pretty much everything in our body is run by electricity.
Wow.
Not that's, chemicals.
That's fascinating for sure. So, okay. So as far as the more EZ that you have in a cell, the healthier you are. Is that an accurate statement, sort of?
Yes, and I can, and the reason is that you need all this negative charge to convert, to undergo the phase transition.
Right.
And if your cell is deficient in EZ, then it can't do what it's supposed to do, and then the cell is dysfunctional or even pathological. Mm-hmm. And And the remedy to that is to try to rebuild the easy water to bring the cell back to health.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the, so it sounds like sunlight is definitely a good way, and probably infrared sauna, right?
Both of those are absolutely good ways. Yeah. Another way is drink a lot of water.
Yeah.
Another way is to do juicing, squeeze the freshly grown leaves to extract the liquid, which is essentially the intracellular water mm-hmm. in those plants filled with EZ. So mm-hmm. you're drinking the EZ directly.
And yet when it goes through your digestion, it's not like it gets disassembled and has to get reassembled. You absorb it just as is already.
Well, let me explain. There are two things that are relevant here. The first is that, the stomach acid is highly acidic and ought to neutralize the water that you drink. On the other hand, the amount of acidic water, the volume is very small. And so if you drink a full glass of water, that small amount of stomach acid shouldn't result in very much neutralization. That's the first thing. The second is, what I really think is going on is that as soon as you eat the food, the food is essentially life, either plant life or animal life, which has a lot of easy water in it, and that's negatively charged. And so as soon as you eat the food, those negative charges will flow to any place in your body where there are fewer negative charges. The electrons are going to flow downhill. So I think the electrons are extracted. And the evidence for this is, maybe you have this experience, you're tired, run down, all you want to do is go to sleep. Already you feel energized. This is the experience of many people. A little bit of food quickly gives you renewed energy.
Mm-hmm.
So how does it do it? Well, I think possibility exists that it's simply that the electrons from the food are extracted.
Mm-hmm.
And used basically to rebuild easy water in your cell.
Hmm.
We know that passing electrons into the cell builds easy water. We've done experiments, taking ordinary liquid water mm-hmm. and you put two electrodes in, and next to the negative electrode, easy builds. Mm-hmm. So all you need to do is put electrons in.
Yeah.
You don't even need the nucleating surface that I was talking about. Just putting negative charge in liquid water creates easy water.
So that makes me think of things like earthing.
And I think that's what happens when you, I'm sorry?
Sorry. Oh, I was going to say that makes me think of things like earthing, grounding, and being like near a waterfall where you're exposed to negatively charged, particles in the air. All of that helps build it as well. Is that true?
All of the above. Yes.
All of the above.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So you got a wide range. And also, I would mention this is maybe less simple than all of those other expedients, but hyperbaric oxygen therapy. We were curious about it because a former postdoc of mine reported to me he was working for a hyperbaric oxygen company, and he said, it's not just wounds that are healed by hyperbaric oxygen therapy. That was it was used originally for that. But he told me there are 29 different syndromes that are helped if you get into a hyperbaric oxygen chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wondered, whether hyperbaric oxygen might build EZ. That was, a simple hypothesis, because if so, we're talking about EZ throughout the body. It doesn't matter where or what the problem is. And mm-hmm. we confirmed that high oxygen builds EZ water, high pressure builds EZ water. So you put the two together and it powerfully builds EZ water. And I think that's another expedient. It's not as simple, because you need a hyperbaric oxygen therapy chamber
in order to get it. Yeah, yeah.
But effective in doing that. And I think that's the reason why those chambers are so effective.
Right. Well, and this also seems to imply at least one of the possible reasons why oxidative stressors are a problem, because they're going to strip away some of the electrons, right? Is that part of the underlying?
Right, exactly.
And what about EMF? Has that been studied at all for this?
Well, it's been studied by a number of people. We actually we actually did some experiments. We put a router, Wi-Fi router, next to a chamber where we have had easy. And the student found that when he turned on the Wi-Fi, it diminished the size of the easy. A technical problem. The student graduated. I haven't been able to track the student or find him.
Oh,
so,
no.
we haven't published, but there's another group who wants to repeat the experiments, and I hope they do, a group, I think, of Germans, because they asked me for all the protocols and such, and so I hope. And then there's the book, The Invisible Rainbow by Arthur Furstenberg.
The book. I haven't read it, but I know what it is, yeah.
Well, it's practically encyclopedic, demonstrating that every time a new advance in electrical energy and communication, whatever, came into being, there was always a pandemic that followed for a year or two after.
Oh yes, I think I have heard that. Uh-huh.
Amazing. I mean, you know, his evidence, as I said, is encyclopedic. You almost wish, okay, enough evidence, you've convinced me, but there's more and more and more. So that book is really a tremendous contribution to understanding. And so I'm sitting here with a laptop on my lap, not knowing exactly the impact, but I also have a cloth that is said to ameliorate the effects or absorb the energy. And whether it works, I'm not sure, but I'm trusting that it might work.
You gotta do. Yeah, absolutely. Makes sense. Sort of speaking of water, what is your opinion of the hydrogen water phenomenon? Does that contribute to this at all?
I have no comment on that because I haven't followed it or studied it.
Okay, so, got it. So. Okay. Yeah, it seemed to me that it should make things worse based on this theory. But
no comment. Because
fair enough. Yeah, absolutely. So let's see. And then you also said ultrasound is another way that you can build easy water as well, or agitation in general, right? Like blending?
You can... You can do that. Ultrasound, you know, we tried ultrasound, did some experiments in which we applied ultrasound. It's the same frequency as used for imaging, ultrasound imaging.
And
so what we found in a series of experiments is you turn on the ultrasound and first easy diminishes. And then you turn off the ultrasound and the EZ builds up and builds to much higher, much larger size than existed initially. Mm-hmm. And eventually, after a goodly amount of time, it returns to the original. So it seems, except for the
initial
brief period of time that it was on, the after effect is to build EZ water.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't studied it anymore. We don't know whether it's pure easy water or whether it might be that bubbles formed and they have easy shells and they actually added to the existing easy, which made the easy look bigger. We're still not sure of that.
Got it. Interesting. That brings up another question I had just on kind of the way that within bulk water, you say that this is constantly... there's how did you phrase it, that there's almost like cells or structures within bulk water, you know, the reflection of water that you can see, where you can see the patterns in it. Do you know what I'm talking about? Am I phrasing this poorly?
No, you're phrasing very well, but I'm okay. Please.
What I'm wondering about is how does it happen when there's no surface to trigger the arrangement of the EZ? Why does it happen spontaneously in like the ocean, for example?
Well, we did experiments and we found that if you apply, say, an electric field to some water,
mm-hmm.
And you know there is an electric field around the Earth, so the Earth is negative, as you pointed out, but up in the ionosphere is positive, which mm-hmm. means it's like a capacitor where you have positive charge up there, negative charge down here, and if you have a capacitor, then you have electric field. Lines going from plus to minus, going in this direction, that is perpendicular to the surface of the Earth.
Huh.
And We did experiments and published them several years ago showing that some frequencies of electric field build easy water. And we don't know why that's the case. Some frequencies don't, but we found that some do. So that's one feature that possibly, you know, we see easy water in the ocean, and this could be one reason why we see it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure of other reasons, but one thing, you know, that I've been thinking about, and I'm sorry for going on beyond your question.
No, that's cool.
Well, you know, from space, the Earth looks blue,
mm-hmm.
right? Water's blue, mm-hmm. but water has no color, right?
No, so, I've wondered about that too.
Yeah, well, easy water does have color because easy water fluoresces. And the fluorescence, we reported that, easy fluorescence, the color depends on what kind of light is illuminating the region of interest. Uh-huh. It depends which wavelength of light. So you can get different fluorescent colors. And I think that's the reason why the ocean is blue, why you can see it blue, because the ocean contains lots of easy water.
Uh-huh.
But also, you know, you see pictures of tropical areas and the water looks blue or blue-green or something like that. And the usual explanation is minerals. But, you know, if you put modest amount of mineral salts in water, you don't get any color.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the fluorescence of the easy water that's creating these colors. And maybe, I don't know, you don't, where you live, there are not too many glaciers. but if you, I was just in Europe, in the Alps, just last week, there were a couple of conferences nearby, and I stopped off, and I could see a lake with a green, blue-green color, mm-hmm. and the lake was created by melting glacier just behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that if you start with ice, as in a glacier, and the ice melts, it melts not directly into easy water, but into liquid water, but easy water first. So ice to easy water to liquid water. And if you want to freeze it, it's exactly the opposite. It's ordinary water to easy water and then to ice.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that a glacier that's melted either into a river or into a pond or a lake is going to have color to mm-hmm. it because of the fluorescence. And that's, I think, why I found on a regular basis that in every country that I've seen this, Austria, Switzerland, Canada, that when the ice melts from mm-hmm. a glacier, the river that's created is green.
Oh, that's amazing. Very cool. So another kind of side note on this, one of the things that I've noticed in practice recently is that for some of my hypersensitive cases, and I'll get to how this relates in a second, for the people that are really, really toxic, one of the very first things I have to do is flush their lymphatic system, so the extracellular fluid, before I start trying to detox the cells. So when I read your book, one of my thoughts was, because there's for most people, that seems to work really well. There's a few people that just don't seem to budge even with that. And so I started to wonder if there's a way we can build up the EZ. Is that what really is lacking? Like, we need to have more fluid in order to flush out all the toxins. Any comments on that or thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I do have comments. So, you know, nobody really has understood what makes the lymphatic vessels flow.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we found an answer not only to lymphatics but to veins and arteries and other vessels in our body. Mm-hmm. May I take a couple minutes to describe?
Please. Yes.
Yeah. Well, so we found in the laboratory we found something again, another undergraduate who I guess didn't really know the importance of what he was studying. One day he came barging into my office. I was sitting with somebody, and you know, he usually I leave my door slightly ajar, because you know, when people want to come in, or students or whatever, I want to welcome them. But usually they're polite, and you know they'll edge the door slightly more open. Are you busy? Can I? You know, some polite. He didn't do that. He just pushed open the door, and I was sitting with a visitor, and the visitor was maybe not so interesting, and so I was very happy that he came in to interrupt the discussion. Yeah. He said, "I found something that you know is interesting, and I wanted to share it with you." So, okay, what did you find that's interesting? He said, "Well, I immersed these tubes made of a material called Nafion into a chamber in a horizontal fashion." I just put it in the chamber, and flow went through the tube, never ending. And I thought, if he's right, this is pretty interesting, because in order to produce that flow, you needed energy. You need like a pressure gradient, you know, sort of like in your cardiovascular system, the heart is generating pressure to send it through the large vessels. So I was thinking this actually substantiates what we had found just earlier, that infrared energy was being absorbed by water and could confer energy, you know, and he demonstrated that was the case. So I was really excited about it. We confirmed, we wrote several papers on it, and we kind of understand the mechanism that inside the vessel, or at least one mechanism, there may be others, inside the vessel, an EZ grows, an annular EZ with mm-hmm. negative charge, yeah. and the positive charge sits right at the core in the center. Mm-hmm. And those positive charges repel each other, mm-hmm. and they're free hydronium ions, and they're going to exit at one end or the other end, depending on various factors. So that... And if the hydronium ions, that is positively charged water, exits from one end, it's going to draw new water in the back end. And mm-hmm. that one is the same thing. It will perpetuate itself. And so that's what we found. And then regarding the lymphatics, I'm getting to that. So I was in Russia and I was visiting my friend, Vladimir Vyakov, who is the effective head of the biochemistry department at Moscow University. And he quickly introduced me to a colleague of his from down the hall. And the guy couldn't speak English, so Vladimir translated. And he started by saying to me, "There's a big problem in the cardiovascular system." And I'm thinking, hey, what is this guy going to tell me? In my PhD, I studied pressures and flows in the cardiovascular system. And, you know, I thought I had it all worked out. And in 5 minutes, he had me convinced that I was wrong.
Wow.
So why am I wrong? He said, the problem is this. The problem is that in the cardiovascular system, the red blood cells have a dimension of 6 or 7 micrometers. On the other hand, some of the small capillaries have a diameter half of that, so something like 3 or 4 micrometers. So you got a plumbing problem, and you know what happens? If your toilet gets stopped up, you need to take a plunger, you know, and plunge. So it requires energy to crunch those red blood cells to. A configuration where they actually can get through those tiny capillaries, and mm-hmm. and I have videos showing that that the red blood cells, which you know has the classic a donut kind of shape, get squeezed as they have to get squeezed, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to go through, and that requires energy. Mm-hmm. So he calculated how much energy is required. And of course, any calculation could be erroneous in some ways, but even if he's wrong by a factor of 10 or 100 or so, still it's a big problem, because he calculated that if the pressure of the ventricle is responsible not only for driving the flow, but for squeezing the red cells, that pressure would need to be something like 1 million times higher than it actually is.
Oh, wow.
That's sort of high blood pressure.
Yeah.
So he might, you know, even if his calculation is off, is a problem. So somehow he concluded that there must be something else besides the heart that's driving the blood. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, well, in the laboratory, we just found this so-called spontaneous flow through tubes. Maybe the same thing is going on there. And we tested it, and we found indeed that that's the case. We just published 2 weeks ago.
Oh, really?
We tested the signature feature of this mechanism, namely that if we add infrared energy, it goes faster, and we found exactly that. So we concluded that in your cardiovascular system and in mine, I guess, not sure of mine, but it's run not only by the heart, but it's also driven by the vessels themselves.
Wow.
Just like in the laboratory. Uh-huh. When you think about it also, my student found literature, and it turns out that when the heart stops, you'd expect that the flow would stop, but it doesn't stop. It actually, he found, it goes on for an extended length of time, indicating that, you know, there's got to be another mechanism besides the heart, because the heart's not pumping anymore.
Right.
He also found in the literature over the past 100 years that there have been, he found, I think, 6 different publications showing exactly that. The heart stops, circulation continues.
Goodness.
Which means, which can only mean that there's got to be something else.
Sure, yeah.
You know, simple logic. So the conclusion of that, I'll get to the lymphatics in a moment. The conclusion of all that is that our circulatory system is driven by two drivers. One is the heart, that we already know, and the other is the vessels themselves.
Wow.
And we actually don't know how much of the energy comes from the heart and how much comes from the vessels, because the setup we used was not capable of demonstrating it. The reason is, you know, when you stop the heart transitions from a pump to an obstacle, sitting there doing nothing.
Right.
And if the vessels are driving the flow, that flow meets that obstacle and slows down.
Sure. So
in order to find out, we got to remove the obstacle. So it might be, you know, it might be the heart represents only a small fraction of the energy that's responsible for driving the flow. Or it might be as thought now, the major contributor. We're not sure. At the same time now, if this flow occurs in the laboratory in various tubes, a whole lot of them we tried, and in the cardiovascular system, then of course it raises the question, well, what about the lymphatics? Why would that be exempted from it? And so I think that the lymphatic flow might actually be driven by this very same mechanism. We haven't written any papers on it, but it seems logical that that's the case. And if you put your hands on there, the infrared from your hands or the pressure can amplify that flow.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. So the idea of manually moving things, or there's herbs that will do it, but you could also do all of the things that will build EZ, and theoretically that would have a similar
absolutely
amplification effect.
Absolutely.
So, amazing. So what have I not asked you that you want to make sure you leave with our audience?
General philosophy.
Okay.
Most of science today, the scientists are dotting the I's and crossing the T's. And we've had almost no scientific revolutions. We had lots of technological revolutions, you know, like the computer that I'm using right now and such. But I'm talking about fundamental scientific revolutions, you know, of the same magnitude as, say, the uncovering of the genetic code that was 65 years ago. The splitting of the atom, that was 75 years ago. It's really hard to think of something like that that's happened in the past 30 or 40 years. And what's the reason for it? So, you know, it might be said that everything that needs to be known or that could be known is already known. And I would challenge that immediately. Mm-hmm. The second reason is that scientists are less clever than they were. You know, that mm-hmm. might be. And the third reason is that there's some obstacle in the way science is getting done. And I think that's the case. So if, for example, if you had an idea, this is an example I'd like to give. You have an idea that the Earth is round, mm-hmm. right? But everybody knows the Earth is flat. That's the prevailing view. It's flat Earth.
Yeah.
And you decide, you know, you've got some, quote, preliminary evidence that mm-hmm. the Earth is round, and you want to get money to get more evidence. Your preliminary evidence is you've assembled some photos taken from satellites and from the moon, and you could see the curvature. Mm-hmm. And you've also decided to take off from where you are, go west, and land in San Francisco, and then Tokyo, and then Beijing, and Afghanistan, and London, keep circling the Earth, and you come back to the same place. And so it looks like that also is, you know, good evidence that the Earth is actually a sphere and is not a flat sheet. Uh-huh. And you assemble that evidence, and you write a proposal, please give me money, either National Science Foundation or whatever foundation. And your application is received by the gatekeeper, mm-hmm. a conscientious young maybe flunky or not, whatever, who gets this job being the gatekeeper and sees, this proposal from Lauren, I don't know her, but this is a pretty radical idea. I would better, in order to make sure that it's properly reviewed, I better recruit the world's experts on the shape of the Earth to see whether this is real, because if it's real, it's really important, or it's flaky. Mm-hmm. And so who are those reviewers? Well, they're the experts in flat Earth, mm-hmm. right? Because everybody thinks. So what you're proposing is to step on their toes.
Of course.
You're right, they're wrong. Mm-hmm. And you know human nature. It doesn't work very well. It's the system that you could be spawning a scientific revolution if you're right about the round Earth, but the system doesn't allow you to do it. And you know, most scientists are clever enough to figure out that they better not challenge the status quo, because they're going to fail. And if they fail, it may be that they won't be able to put bread on the table of their families. Some people are supported, their own salaries are supported by grants. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful about that. I hesitate to use the word corrupt because the system is not really intended to be corrupt, but it suffers this kind of serious problem. And I think mm-hmm. I think that may be the reason why we've had no scientific revolutions. We need revolutions. We need them badly because revolutions inevitably lead to new technologies, and we need these new technologies to help solve the many problems of the world, but we're not getting them. We're just getting incremental improvements. So I think that, first of all, the system needs to change. It's seriously antithetical to the development of radical ideas. We're impacted just as well. It's almost impossible, you know, with our, you might say, radical views of biology and beyond, to get money. It's a real struggle, and in order to keep going, we need funding. But it's really hard to get funding for the reasons that I just mentioned. Right. And so, at the risk of belaboring the point, I just want to say that it's really important to study fundamentals. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't, for example, any foundation that we like to build on needs to be secure. It needs to be firm. Otherwise, any mechanism that builds on a foundation that's not correct is going to be just very complicated and frankly wrong. Mm-hmm. So my view is that, you know, somehow we should not hesitate to go down to the deepest foundational levels and build up from there.
Yeah.
And well, I'm trying to do that. I've got two books coming, and one of them is actually on the second one is on the structure of the atom.
Oh, wow. Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, we learn that the atom is like a solar system. You know, we learned that in middle school, mm-hmm. but how do we know it's correct? It was put forth by a human being.
Sure.
Yeah. And human beings can be wrong, although we like to think they're right. It's been in the textbooks for five generations, you know. And is it right? So I think convince you in 2 minutes that there's something fundamentally wrong. If I may, just
yeah, please.
Yeah. Okay. So you have a nucleus. Nucleus consists of, in theory, consists of protons and neutrons. The neutrons are neutral. They're just sort of like dead weight. Mm-hmm. Protons are positively charged. Mm-hmm. You squeeze positive charges together. What do they want to do?
Repel.
So the nucleus should explode. Mm-hmm. Now, the physicists recognized this fundamental problem, and they invented something called, quote, the strong force.
Yes.
So no evidence for the no independent evidence, it just sort of glue that was invented to hold it all together.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then I'll give you one more, but there are a half dozen. One more is that nucleus is positively charged, mm-hmm. electrons are negatively charged. Mm-hmm. I learned in middle school that minus and plus attract one another.
Right.
Therefore, why don't those electrons attracted to the nucleus collapse onto the nucleus? Basically meaning that there's no atom anymore.
It's just annihilate, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of the fundamental flaws. Mm-hmm. The atom needs to be stable. It can't explode and it can't contract to nothing. Mm-hmm. And so I've indeed come up with an alternative model that I think explains the evidence better.
Wow.
I'm giving you this just as an example.
Yeah.
Of that we really need to be sure of the foundation. If we're not sure of the foundation, everything will be super complicated. That's where we are today.
Sure, yeah. It's the Occam's razor thing, right? The idea
of Occam's razor thing, exactly. Right. Yeah. Simplicity. Nature operates on simplicity.
Mm-hmm. So when's that book coming out?
Well, the limiting factor is the artist, who is my son.
Mm-hmm.
He's supremely talented. If you read the fourth phase book, you'll see.
Oh, that was him.
Yeah, that was him.
Okay.
And he decided a few years ago that his family is growing, that he needed a home remodel. And Dad, if you don't mind, I'm going to do it. I'm going to have to take a year off to do it. Well, mm-hmm. 3.5 years later, finally, he's getting back to it.
Oh, yeah.
So he's working on the first book, which I didn't mention, first new book, which deals with the unsuspected role of electricity in mm-hmm. nature that we see around us. So many things, I believe, the evidence suggests are run by electric charge. We don't think of it that way. And that ranges all the way from weather, in which I spent 4 chapters developing how weather actually works from first principles up to hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
I won't find anything anywhere on that because I think it doesn't exist. So I made an attempt. Gravitation, how that works, how birds fly, how fish swim, and stuff like that. And
I don't shy away from anything.
Pardon me?
I said you don't shy away from anything.
No, I don't shy away because, you know, deep down, and I can't figure out what the reasons are, but I'm looking for truth at the most fundamental level. And so I'm also, you know, just before this interview, I was working on chapter 3 of my book on volcanoes and earthquakes. So no, I don't shy away from anything. I think water is involved in a way that I'll leave the explanation for the book, but sure. Very simple. Right now, we have no idea where the energy comes from, the energy to power a volcanic eruption or an earthquake, which we're anticipating in the Seattle area where I live, a 9.1. It's happened, if I remember the span of time, roughly every 300 or 350 years, many times, on and on, and we're way beyond, we're overdue. Yeah.
Anytime.
So, you know, the devastating earthquakes that we hear about all the time are usually magnitude 7 or something like that. 9 or 9.1 is 100 times stronger.
Right. My goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, where can people go who want to find out more about you?
There are many, many presentations on the internet, slide presentations, there are other interviews, but I think the best place is to read the book, The Fourth Phase of Water. The book has turned out to be very popular. And I think popularity is probably rests on the artistic contribution of my son.
also how revolutionary the idea is too.
Well, yeah, there are revolutionary ideas, but I'm proud of my son and how he illustrates. He's a sculptor by training. And one day he said, "Dad, I would like to illustrate your books." Mm-hmm. So there we are. I think that's the best place, the fourth phase of water. And there are many papers in the literature, if you just look under my name, or on my website, university website, pollocklab.org, you can find a lot there as well.
Fantastic. Well, I will link to the book and to your website in the show notes. And thank you, Jerry. This has been fantastic.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It's really fun. And please take care. And it was really my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Are you looking for a holistically minded healthcare practitioner who truly treats root cause rather than symptom suppression? Unfortunately, even in the alternative healing professions, this isn't a given. That's why I've created wholehealthdoctor.com, a resource to help connect patients to healthcare practitioners in their area who share a root cause philosophy. Alternatively, most of the practitioners listed also practice telehealth. So if there isn't anyone local to you, you can still find a great practitioner to help you regain optimal health. Go to wholehealthdoctor.com. That's wholehealthdr.com. Type in your location or just the specialty that you're looking for and find the practitioner who's right for you.
Thanks for listening to Christian Natural Health. This show is run by you, so please write in with topic and guest suggestions for future shows. For more great content, subscribe to Dr. Lauren's blog at www.drlaurendeville.com or follow her on Facebook or Twitter at Dr. Lauren Deville. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to share it with your friends and give us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It really helps us to stand out so other people can discover great content as well. Have a great week and God bless you.
God's Word will change our life, but sometimes it's hard to know where to start. Well, that's where I come in. I'm Jody Nisnik, host of So Much More, Creating Space for God, a scripture meditation podcast. And each week, I guide you through a scripture, giving you space to listen to the Spirit and pray about what's on your heart. Then we have a thoughtful conversation with guests to help us go deeper. Listen and subscribe at lifeaudio.com.